Welcome to Extra Credit, S&P Global Ratings U.S. Public Finance Podcast with Lisa Schroyer, a biweekly series that makes municipal market analysis mobile. Listen in as Lisa highlights S&P analysts' perspective on major public finance issues.
Fall is upon us, and with the changing of the leaves, we have the changing of a regular feature of the show. So, always a fan of alliteration, our co-host Tiffany Tribbett is with us today to talk on pensions and OPEB for our rebranded show, Retirement Roundup. So, Tiffany, what do you have for us today?
Well, Lisa, healthcare is the theme of the day. First, looking at the pension landscape for not-for-profit healthcare systems, then turning to a survey of post-retirement medical benefits across the country. To guide us in our journey, I have three members of our pension lift team on today. Ann Cosgrove, a director in our healthcare group, Jill Legnos, an associate director in our states and transportation team, and our frequent talker, Todd Canister, our resident actuary and director of municipal pensions. Welcome, everybody. Let's start with healthcare. Ann, you published an article in July with Todd and Wendy Tauber on U.S. not-for-profit healthcare pensions, noting that funded ratios improved, but the trend is not expected to continue. That seems a bit ominous. Can you give us an overview of the pension landscape in the healthcare sector and explain why we expect funding volatility in the near term?
Of course. Well, overall, the not-for-profit pension landscape has been improving, given that the median funded status of defined benefit plans increased in fiscal 2018 to 85% from 80.6% 1 year ago, primarily due to a higher bond rate. But as we all know, based on historical bond rate volatility, we do not view this as a fundamental improvement to the funding status. Overall pension costs for the majority of our not-for-profit hospitals that issue FASB statements, those remain low and very manageable. However, for some of our governmental accounting standards board issuers, costs have been a source of credit pressure. In addition, a significant number of our issuers have been de-risking their pensions by freezing their plans or closing to new entrants.
That's really interesting that so many are freezing the plans or closing them to new entrants. What do you think is driving that decision?
Not-for-profit entities continue to de-risk their plans with this mechanism. In addition, many FASB entities are governed under the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, more commonly known as ERISA, and therefore have to pay premiums to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corp on their unfunded liabilities. And if they decrease this, they also decrease the premium they have to pay. All ERISA plans pay a small fixed rate premium per participant. Poorly funded plans pay a higher variable rate premium on unfunded liabilities.
Ah, the FASB versus GASB accounting discussion. I found that part of the article quite interesting, in particular the discussion of how it affects funded ratios. I know Todd really enjoys the accounting here, so Todd, can you break this down for us?
Thank you, Tiffany. Yes. FASB and GASB are designed to cover very different entities, but not-for-profit healthcare is interesting in that there are entities within the sector that may be covered by one or the other. So now, while it may be tempting to compare liabilities between a FASB entity and a GASB entity, we have to remember that the word liability has a very different meaning between the two. Most notably, under GASB, the discount rate generally reflects the assumed asset return and is fairly stable over time at just over 7% on average. Under FASB, however, the discount rate represents a volatile point-in-time estimate that is completely separate from the assumed return and closer to 4%. So the bottom line here is that with a much lower discount rate, the funded ratio for a FASB plan will be lower than that of an equivalent GASB plan. So as Anne noted just now, FASB issuers tend to have lower costs and less pension risk at this time.
It's really interesting to me to see how the reporting standards are so different between GASB and FASB, but it's also really interesting to hear that just a lot of not-for-profit healthcare entities are moving away from defined benefit plans to mitigate that budgetary pressure. Now, let's turn from the healthcare sector to healthcare benefits. Todd, you and Jill recently published a 50-state survey on OPEB benefits focused on post-retirement medical benefits offered by state governments. I know that I, perhaps like many others listening, view these as softer liabilities than pensions. Should I?
Absolutely not. And by that, I mean, it depends. States have very different laws with regard to OPEB benefit reductions. Some states treat retiree healthcare benefits to be sacrosanct, like pensions, while others allow complete removal at any time. So while there may be more cost-saving options for OPEBs, and likely there is, The pervasive idea that the benefit is always soft is absolutely changing. So now issuers with a limited ability and no plan to manage these retiree healthcare costs, combined with no plan in place for advanced funding, will be viewed increasingly harshly as these costs escalate exponentially.
I suppose I can get on board with agreeing that there are some real risk for issuers, particularly in states that restrict their ability to modify these benefits. Keeping that in mind, Jill, how do the benefits offered by OPEB plans ultimately affect a state's creditworthiness?
So there are many factors that go into our assessment of a state's OPEB profile. We think that an important piece of the conversation, not just at S&P, but industry-wide, is an understanding of what benefits are being offered to whom and for how long. So the answers to these questions really do affect, you know, the size of the liability and have potential to impact state budgets. As an example, retiree health care benefits can be provided for as a percentage of insurance premiums. This actually exposes the state's finances to volatile health care costs, which historically have grown much faster than inflation.
Yeah, I know we're really looking at those long-term medical cost trends and how they really outpace inflation. So what does the landscape of these benefits look like across the country, Jill?
So our report, we surveyed the largest OPEB plan within each state. And looking at these findings, we gained insight into what a typical state OPEB plan looks like. So thinking back to those three questions I just discussed, you know, what benefits are being offered? So our survey found that around 60% of state plans, you know, that we surveyed are provided for explicitly. So either a state will pay a percentage of insurance premiums, like we just discussed, or they'll specify a fixed monthly dollar amount for the benefit, and this limits exposure to medical cost trend. Who are the benefits being provided to? For nearly all of the plans surveyed, dependents, typically a spouse, are eligible for coverage. What's unique is that unlike pension plans, many OPEB plans offer spousal benefits concurrent to employee benefits. So from a cost perspective, it's about twice as expensive compared to pension plans. And lastly, how long can a participant utilize these benefits? So about 90% of the plans we surveyed reduced benefits at Medicare eligibility in some form. So most states are really shifting at least a portion of these costs to the federal government when they can.
That 90% number really jumps out. That's so large. It really does seem like the states that aren't shifting some of these costs at Medicare eligibility are really in the minority here. So overall, this has been a really interesting conversation. So thank you, Jill, for bringing us the survey. Now I'm going to flip it back to you, Lisa. Can you wrap us up?
When you say wrap us up, honestly, the first thing that came to mind was dates and bacon. But I'm going to try and stay on topic. I'd also like to applaud everyone for keeping a straight voice when emphasizing FASB and GASB multiple times over. So good job.
We really care about accounting.
Exactly. You should. And so I'm really interested in what we covered here, obviously. I'm also very curious about where we're going. So I am going to put you guys on the spot and ask you to answer, if you can, your forward-looking view on pensions and OPEB for your sector. So, Jill, can I start with you? What do you think is going to happen in the OPEB landscape for states?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we speak with state governments every day. So thinking about these conversations and the results of our survey, we're seeing that states with large unfunded OPEB liabilities are really starting to think about how they can address them going forward. Likely this will be through some combination of benefit modifications and pre-funding of the liability, but it will really depend on each state's specific financial situation.
Okay, great. And Todd, our resident contrarian, just to everything, do you agree?
Assuming the landscape of healthcare in the U.S. stays essentially the same, there's increasing awareness of the future cost trajectories of retiree healthcare as well as the risks. So employers are more able to set benefits to an affordable level going forward. They will then further reduce risk by pre-funding those benefits.
That's great, Todd. And the way you said that, it just makes me want to turn the page and see what happens. So Anne, your turn. Where do you think pensions are going to go for the healthcare sector?
That's very interesting, Lisa. We do expect continued volatility in the funding levels of pension plans, given the annual fluctuation, both the bond rate and the uncertainty in the investment markets. However, most providers are making adequate contributions to their pension plans, and we do expect overall pension costs to be somewhat lower and manageable for most healthcare providers in the not-for-profit space. In addition, a number of these providers continue to de-risk and shift to defined contribution plans. And at this point in time, about 33% of our not-for-profit portfolio are in defined contribution plans. However, there are exceptions to this where we do have some outliers, and particularly, as I noted before, in the GASB, in our GASB universe.
Well, this is a great first retirement roundup session, and I thank everyone for listening. Tiffany, I thank you very much for hosting this week's Extra Credit. If you have any feedback, listeners, please email us at uspffeedback@spglobal.com. We're your hosts, Lisa and Tiffany. Until next time.
To subscribe to this podcast, or if you're interested in any of our written analysis, head to spratings.com/US Public Finance. This has been Extra Credit, S&P Global Ratings U.S. Public Finance Podcast with Lisa Schroyer, making municipal market analysis mobile.